Welcome to Left, Right, and Unwanted, the podcast where people across the political spectrum discuss ideas and politics. I'm Lauren, and I'm the left.
I'm Morgan, and I'm the right.
I'm Luke, and I'm the unwanted. What do you guys think about traffic? Do you like it?
Oh, my favorite.
I hate driving, so by extension, I also hate traffic.
I would rather have a longer route that I can... I'd rather take 30 minutes to drive out of my way somewhere if I can keep driving than to like sit in my car for 30 minutes.
I will always take the interstate if I can compared to cutting through Omaha. Having to stop at a stoplight, that just kills me. I just set it on cruise and then I sort of let my mind wander. And then I arrive at my destination and I'm like, how did I get here? I don't remember driving here, but I'm here. So I must have gotten here somehow.
Do you wonder why your wife complains about your drive?
Kevin Cruz is a history professor at Princeton University, and some of his interests include religion, the civil rights movement, and race. Atlanta has clearly been an interest of his for some time because he has a book called White Flight, Atlanta and the Making of Modern Conservatism. Currently, he's focused on teaching about race relations in America, politics, and travel in suburbia.
This article continues what I think is a pretty common theme in the 1619 Project of me ultimately disagreeing with the point of their article. They touch on some interesting things in the article that I wish they would have focused on and written the article about, but they don't. And then they write this other article. Spoiler alert, I don't think that the traffic is because of racism.
I felt the same way about some of the points in here. Just to kind of piggyback off of that, my issue with it was he begins by asserting today's bumper-to-bumper, like gridlock traffic in Atlanta can be traced back to racism. And I didn't think he ever revisited that claim or supported it. But I liked some of the things he brought up in the middle.
He had that one quote from the mayor in the 1950s. Interstate 20, the east-west corridor that connects with I-75 and I-85 in Atlanta Center, was deliberately plotted along a winding route in the late 1950s to serve, in the words of Mayor Bill Hartsfield, as, quote, the boundary between the white and Negro communities, unquote, on the west side of town. I don't know anything about city planning in the 1950s, but I know a little bit about city planning now. And there is so much that goes into deciding where roads go and how roads are built and where they're going to lead to and go from. Like, it just seems like a very large leap to me to make from a quote that I believe is true. It made a difference in the 1950s, but now is not causing gridlock traffic that we have.
Yeah, whenever people talk about city planning, I think back to our discussion of state simplification, which I think is our most referenced article.
It is. I just love it.
And I just think about how hard, if not, I mean, it's basically impossible to determine not only now where everyone will want to drive on any given day at any given time, but 10, 20, 30 years in the future, because now the interstates are getting to, some interstates are like 70 years old now. I mean, there's just no way that people could have.
A lot of our infrastructure is hitting like when it was designed to last until like roads and bridges. And that's a huge, huge part of traffic design is trying to predict what it's going to be like. And when it's predicted wrong is when you have problems and they can't always be fixed by adding a lane to a highway. A lot of times that's going to make it worse if you just try to slap a lane on there. I took several transportation classes in college and there's a lot that goes into it. Lots of variables. And it's a very challenging thing to do, especially in very populous areas.
Independent of this article, do both of you prefer cars or public transportation in your daily life?
In my daily life, with where I live, I prefer my car. That's a combination of their not being great public transportation and how close I live to where I go often. I have been to cities though with a lot of public transportation. And I like that because it's an area I'm unfamiliar with and there's lots of traffic and I can just easily walk to places I need to go or use. In New York City, I can use the subway station. In DC, I can use the metro. And so I like it there. But I don't know if there was a good public transportation system where I live, if I would use that instead.
I think that it's really less about what I prefer and more about what the city is built around what I'm doing there. Like usually when you're going to some place for touristy reasons, you're going to stay mainly in the city center and you can get around to transport. But in a place like Omaha, which was not built around public transport and where I want to go to Walmart or my parents' house or, you know, whatever it is, it's just not, I can't think of a public transportation system that would be effective for getting to the places that when I get around downtown, I walk or ride a bike. I rarely drive downtown, which is probably where you put a public transport system anyway. And I do like the individuality of the car. I mean, America is just so much different from Europe in that America is so much young and has so much bigger spaces that mm-hmm. public transport's harder because we're much less dense. And also population shifts so fast in the U.S. Like Florida was one of the 10 least populated states in America until like the 50s. Nebraska used to have more population than California. And it just, if you built a public transport in like the 50s, Detroit would have been like a major hub. And now who wants to go to Detroit? Whereas in Europe, when you have these cities that have been around for 1,000, 2,000 years, you know, they're not going anywhere. So it's safe to put that as a hub for your transport. And I think that's a difficulty in getting public transport in the US.
For reasons that are only based on my wants, I vastly prefer public because I hate driving. It's as simple as that. I just hate it. Even if it'd be a long commute and I had a lot of things with me, if there were a public transportation option for me to get to work, I'd take it. But that's more due to my own preferences, not really due to how I structure moving around the city. Like lack of public transportation in my area doesn't prevent me from doing things, but if we lived in a transport utopia, if I were the one designing it, there would be no cars. Urban design is not neutral. It either perpetuates or reduces social inequities within cities. Do you agree or disagree with that statement?
It's hard for me to understand or decide because I haven't lived somewhere that's had good public transportation options. Like even in college, which had more options. I mean, honestly, where I went to school was probably the best, like with bus routes and stuff, because they knew they had college kids that didn't have cars and stuff. It's just like, if you don't have a car, yeah, I don't know how you would, if you don't have a car or somebody who you can depend on for rides all the time, I don't know what you would do.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's inaccurate to say the way you design a city or portions of a city is going to affect, you know, I mean, you're going to make choices that are going to end up helping certain sort of people or other sorts of people. And I don't think that that's untrue. His argument is basically that after the Civil War, the goal was segregation to keep whites. And he says here, once they had no need to keep constant watch over African Americans, referring to, you know, making sure slaves weren't running away, whites wanted them out of sight. Civic planners pushed them into ghettos, and the segregation we know today became the rule. So at first he talks about how Southern cities had laws that mandated residential racial segregation. And then during the New Deal, federal agencies encouraged redlining practices that marked minority neighborhoods as risky investments. And basically the way this worked is the federal government wouldn't insure your mortgage unless you followed certain criteria. And one of those criteria was basically not renting certain houses to Black people, which was a federal program that basically segregated a lot of cities. I've seen the redlining maps of Omaha, and I'm sure there's redlining maps. I mean, I know there's redlining maps in basically every major city in the United States because of this New Deal program. And there's been a lot written on that then he talks about, and this is what I think the most interesting part of the article, is then he talks about the construction of the interstate highway system. So Eisenhower comes back from Germany, sees the Autobahn, and is super impressed and wants to build this new interstate system throughout the U.S. And the federal government pays 90% of the costs, and then all these places put interstates in. And this is, I think, another example of state simplification, where highways before were much more organic. And so they went through downtown areas and they went through towns and cities. And then the interstate was built around getting from point A to point B fast. You sit down with a map, you take a ruler, you draw the line, and you build the interstate. And like, I mean, even like the movie Cars, where all these towns that were dependent on the highways going through are now just totally left out of the picture, like Radiator Springs and Cars, as the interstate bypasses these areas in favor of more efficient routes. And I think it's another example of state simplification, picking winners and losers. And it's also why driving on highways is so much more interesting, I think, when you're going through the United States than driving on interstates, which go around cities and small towns, and highways go right through them. It's slower though. So, and he mentions the fact that the interstates were planned to go through, quote, blighted neighborhoods and basically destroy them in order to build the interstate. And that's definitely true. I mean, it happened in Omaha. 480 was intentionally designed to go through poor neighborhoods. I don't know if part of it though is related to the fact that poor neighborhoods are cheaper to buy via eminent domain or not, but yeah, it was definitely. And then this is the quote that Morgan was talking about earlier, where allegedly in Atlanta, the mayor picked the interstate as the boundary between communities. I don't doubt that that was probably a consideration in the building of a lot of interstate systems. And I think a focus on that, I think there's gotta be tons of great stories there. I remember there was a really famous Supreme Court case that dealt with the interstate going through Tennessee or Kentucky through a historic district. And I remember reading about that. And I think that alone is probably interesting enough to write a whole article on. I wish you would have focused more on the section rather than having just a paragraph about it.
Well, and looking at communities today, I would argue that a lot of the segregation that may have been set up with the interstate as one of the boundaries is still around. I mean, any city you look at, any big enough city, there's different little pockets of each city. Like in Omaha, for example, there's West O, there's South O, there's North O, and each pocket comes with its own associations of like who lives there, who should be there, what other places think about it. I mean, I think any Omahan you ask could tell you exactly who stereotypically lives in each area.
I also wonder how much of that stuff is voluntarily perpetuated. I think there is a tendency for humans to want to live with people that are like them. I don't know how much of that is, you know, if a Black person, I don't want to be the only Black person in a neighborhood, so I'm not going to move to that neighborhood, I'm going to move to this neighborhood. Or I just, you know, you're an immigrant or someone who just came into town, what area of town is going to make me feel the most comfortable to live in? When people
builds on itself. But no, I see what you mean.
Well, but that in turn affects property value, for one. Depending on which neighborhood you're in, you have different choices to make when you want to buy or sell a new home. And it also seems to impact schools too. So like where you live, and if this was all set up.
A big thing.
I mean, yeah, that's part of it too. Sometimes it affects resources available to you. Like you might live in a little pocket of town that doesn't have conveniences other areas take for granted. So earlier in the article, he talked about post-war programs for urban renewal. And I couldn't help think about like gentrification of urban areas today. And you look at what was described back then, like the quote he has in here, he said, it was a memorable phrase from someone named James Baldwin, urban renewal means when you renew an urban area, like Black people had to leave, is how people felt at the time. And when you look at communities being renovated or turned into little business parks or being made accessible. You're looking at removal of groups who, no matter how they got there, have already been there for generations.
Why would congestion be the result of racism? Why would the path of a highway produce 3-mile traffic jams that last 4 hours or more when the downtown connector is, as he notes, a 12 to 14 lane mega highway? Isn't it more likely that the problem's just an excess of people trying to commute by car, regardless of the neighborhoods bisected by the road?
I was trying to make a case for it, and the closest I could get, and it's kind of a leap, but if we take what he says as true, in that this directly contributes to traffic congestion today, I suppose it could be due to the fact that so we have passing patterns adapting to match traffic, and traffic maybe in return adapting to match housing patterns. If you assume that residential areas where affluent people live are changing, you could also maybe make a leap and assume business centers and places of commerce are drifting too. So, and he didn't really come out and say this, but I'm wondering if he's staking this on the fact that all of these shifts tie back into the initial setup of the highway. That was the closest I could get to kind of making a case for it.
He moves into a talk about opposition to increased public transit. And he alleges that the white suburbanites had purposefully left the problems of the central city behind and worried that mass transit would bring it back, bring them the problems back. And they waged a campaign against the Rapid Transit Authority. He says residents of the nearly all-white Cobb County resoundedly rejected the system in a 1965 vote. MARTA, this Metropolitan Atlanta Rapid Transit Authority, is rejected from expanding. And in 1987, David Chestnut insists that suburban opposition to mass transit had been 90% a racial issue. I don't know how unbiased a source that guy is, especially when Gwinnett County voted MARTA down. Well, so it says, even as the suburbs became more racially diverse, they remained opposed to MARTA. He said that non-white suburbanite, and then earlier in 2019, Gwinnett County voted MARTA down for a third time. And officials discovered that non-white suburbanites shared the same instincts. Doesn't that undermine the whole point of the piece? Is that it's all about racism, it's all about racism. And even these, you know, minorities are also voting down MARTA. Isn't it just a simpler explanation to say there are reasons to oppose the expansion of public transport other than race? For the first, I mean, it costs a ton of money. Like, why would you get mad at suburban Atlanta voters for declining to fund an expensive light rail transit project, the ballot box? All metro rail systems in the U.S., including subways, elevated trains, light rails, all of them lose money. Even in New York, Washington, D.C., Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco, they all lose money on every trip.
And they don't go outside. They don't really go outside of the city. You're not connecting from an outside suburb. I mean, I'm sure there are a couple lines, but it's for the most part localized. That last paragraph where he mentions, as it's getting more racially diverse, the vote's still not changing. So I don't know. And the money for it has to come from somewhere. I mean, nothing is ever free. If you have a car to go into the city when you need to, you're not going to want to pay for a public transportation system.
Yeah, I don't want to pay for something I'm not going to use is, to me, a compelling argument. If someone's like, hey, do you want to pay for this thing you're not going to use? I'd be like, no, I don't.
I did find some stuff on kind of looking at this from the perspective of a transit system instead of from the perspective of citizens, which still kind of gets at how transit systems have to evolve to meet needs. And it's the idea of dependent versus choice riders. And when you look at a transit system, there are some people in a city who are dependent on the system. It is their only means of transportation. It is how they get everywhere. Without its existence, they're not going to get from point A to point B. And then The other group is the exact opposite. When you look at choice riders, those are people who have multiple options for getting around, either due to finances, location, or other, but public transit is something they don't need. It's very much a choice or a preference or something extra. So if you're a transit company and you need to make money, you need to update your systems, you need to keep them safe and functional for everyone. When you're making choices, the argument is that you're going to think in favor of your choice riders. If someone is already dependent on your system, regardless of the quality you're putting out, they still have to use it and they likely still will. They don't have any other options. So we see a lot of systems putting emphasis on factors that traditionally and like stereotypically would make white riders more comfortable. The idea is that in most cities, statistically, more of your dependent riders are going to be from minority communities and more of your choice riders are likely to be white people. So when you look at modifications going in place for transit systems, they often favor white riders.
Well, and not only that, anytime you have to push major change through the transit system, you got to get funding for it, which means you have to have political connections. And right. Wealthy people are going to have more political connections. I mean, I'm just thinking about Omaha, where we put this big expansion in of these rapid transit buses, with these big orange double buses. I see them all the time, and they're always empty. Like, I've never seen a bus in Omaha that was full, except during the College World Series. Like, they're never full. We don't need bigger buses. That's just not a need that we have. I don't know how many times I've seen buses that are empty. I mean, buses are by far the most cost-effective public transport mechanism, and they can also offer the most choice in terms of people. I mean, you can get all across this, pretty much any city in America on a bus. It just takes longer.
Yeah, they're the most flexible. You don't have to have a whole separate mechanism for it.
And you don't have to make a set route. I mean, when you build a railroad, the train's going to be on that railroad until the railroad goes away. Whereas a bus, as population changes, can change routes. And so, I mean, of expansions of public transit, I mean, I think buses are the way to go, and they can service wider areas. I'm really hopeful in technological change to alleviate some of these issues. First, in terms of congestion, freeing up things like telework and telecommuting and work from home, I think is going to put less people on the road ultimately. But I mean, most blue collar jobs aren't like that though. But, and then the other thing that I'm really hopeful in is self-driving cars theoretically rapidly reduce congestion because they're so much more efficient. They don't have human error involved and all that kinds of things. And also, I don't know if you've watched like Westworld or something, where they basically have Uber mixed with self-driving cars, where you just, you know, get your phone and everyone has a phone now, even the poorest people. I mean, every homeless person I've seen.
It's a necessity. It's not a luxury now. Phone.
Right. And you know, you can call up basically like a self-driving car. It comes and picks you up and takes you to some other place, and it's pretty cheap. Uber really made it, really replaced a lot of public transport, at least pre-pandemic. So I'm hopeful that changes like that can help get rid of this issue, but we'll see. Thank you for listening to this episode of Left, Right, and Unwanted. Please tune in next time.